Call to order the organizational meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee. Apologize for a late start, but we had a quite robust discussion on the floor, which led us to a little bit of a late start here. Today, we're going to do an overview of energy issues, but first we have to take care of some business for the committee. So I will ask for a motion.
Chair Dingfelder, I move that we adopt the rules for the House Committee on Energy and Environment as proposed in front of us here.
Representative Cannon moves the adoption of the committee rules. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, those who are of the opinion that the rules should be adopted will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The assistant will call the roll.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Byer.
Excused.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Burley.
Excused.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye. Okay, with that, the committee rules are adopted. So I'm going to close the organizational meeting, or do we want to do introductions first?
You could do those first.
Okay. We're going to do some brief committee introductions. Many of you, actually, the only freshman we have on this committee is Representative Cannon, so I will ask him to go first. But I would like the members to just give a very brief introduction on your district and maybe any interest or background you have on energy and environment issues.
Great. Thanks, Chair Dingfelder. I'm Representative Ben Cannon. I represent District 46 in Multnomah County, parts of southeast and northeast Portland, centered in the Mount Tabor and Laurelhurst area. I'm a school teacher. I'm taking a leave of absence from my ordinary course of business, which is teaching humanities to 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. It's an honor to serve on the Committee on Energy and Environment. This is a very personal issue for me, as I have told constituents. I hope to have 50 years more on this planet, and if you look at our trends, particularly around global warming and fossil fuel emission and air quality and water quality, and think it's not looking very good for the next generation. And so it's an honor to work with my fellow committee members and with the chair to help advance some great public policy related to energy and the environment through this committee.
Great. Thank you, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Greg McPherson. I represent House District 38, which is Lake Oswego, part of southwest Portland, and a few unincorporated pockets of Clackamas and Multnomah counties. This is my third session in the legislature, but this will be my first opportunity this session to serve on natural resource and environmental-related committees. So I'm looking forward to that opportunity, and I've come to that with a background as a law background, which is not particularly relevant, but I represent a metropolitan district now, but I grew up on a dairy farm in Linn County, as I'm fond of reminding my colleagues, so I have seen a range of issues in different settings in our state.
Great. Thank you. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. I'm Representative Greg Smith. I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57, which is Morrow, the best parts of Umatilla County. That means I can never run for the Senate. Union and Wallowa County. And this is my fourth term in this building. Love this building. Respect this building. My background is I do business development and have a little bit of background in energy and natural resource issues.
Great. Thank you. Representative Byer, would you like to vote on the committee rules?
Yes, aye.
Is that registered? Thank you. And we're just briefly giving a little background.
All right. I am Representative Terry Byer. I represent House District 12, which is the city of Springfield, and am surrounded by other people. So I have a very nice district, one school district, one city to represent, which works out very well for me. This is the first session that I've been assigned to work on the energy issues. I have worked on I've worked on ag and natural resources before, but I don't think most of those are the issues I'll be dealing with here. So I hope I don't have too steep of a learning curve, and I appreciate being able to work with the chair and on these issues.
Excellent. Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Bob Jensen. I represent House District 58. And for those of you unfamiliar with the geography of the state, it's just part of that uncharted wilderness that's east of the Cascades quite a ways. I'm an unapologetic advocate and spokesman for hydropower, the one truly renewable energy source that we have in this country.
Thank you, Representative. And I'm Representative Jackie Dingfelder. I represent House District 45 in Northeast Portland, and I'm starting my fourth term. I actually am very excited about chairing this committee with such a talented group of folks, and I will say that I've learned everything I know about running a committee from Representative Jensen, so if I do mess up, I can just blame my good colleague over here, which is very convenient having him on the committee. With that said, it is, I think, we are poised to do
Madam Chair, is that an illustration of no good deed will go unpunished?
That's exactly right. I'm very excited about this committee because I think we're poised to really be a leader on renewable energy and renewable fuels here in the West Coast. As you know, I worked very hard on a bill with former Representative Jeff Krupp, who I've heard is still lurking in the building, on this one of the issues we're going to be hearing about today. So I'm very excited to see that we're going to have an opportunity to work on that some more. And I think we'll have some very robust discussions about Oregon's future in energy and environmental issues. This committee will also be working on water issues. Some of you may have noticed that the Water Committee has gone away, but it's actually been folded into this committee. And that's another reason why Representative Jensen is here, because what would a Water Committee be without Representative Jensen and I? And also we'll be dealing with some land use issues. So with that, I'm going to close the organizational meeting, and I'm going to open the informational meeting. I do want to remind folks, if you have pagers or cell phones on, to please turn them off because they sometimes buzz. And also, if you do need to have a conversation, I'm going to ask folks to go out in the hall because it's hard for us to hear when there's a lot of background noise going on. So today, we have a very full agenda, and the purpose of today's hearing is to provide an energy introduction and overview for all of us. You guys are the experts on many issues in energy, and as you are well aware, it's a very complicated issue. I would like the committee members to hear directly from the different interest groups in the audience today about what your priorities are and about the type of services that you provide, the programs that you provide. Today we will hear from private and public utilities, business and industrial groups, and consumer and citizen representatives. Again, I just want to emphasize that I'm going to ask you to be brief. I've asked everybody to keep their remarks to about 5 minutes because obviously we have a full room. And to also be aware that we will have plenty of opportunities to discuss the different bills that will be in front of this committee. So I'm going to ask you really to keep your remarks general. And we're going to hold questions until the end of each panel just for the sake of efficiency. So the first panel that's going to come up that I'm going to ask today is representing the private utilities, and we have Gary Bauer from Northwest Natural. Oh, I'm sorry. We're starting actually with an energy overview from the governor's office and also Mike MacArthur. So we have Mike Graney from the Department of Energy, David Vantoff from the governor's office of sustainability, and Mike MacArthur from the Association of Oregon Counties. So I'd like to ask all three of you to come up, and again, if you can limit your remarks to about 5 minutes, and then we'll have the private utilities come up after that. And just a reminder to state your name for the record. And I will, just a reminder, committee members, I will ask if you can hold your questions until the end of the panel, and then we'll take questions at the end of each panel. So, Mr. Graney, are you going to start? Or?
Dave's going to go first.
Okay. Mr. Vantoff.
For the record, my name is Dave Vantoff, the Governor's Sustainability Policy Advisor.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of the governor here today. The governor has made energy independence and combating global warming priorities of his administration, and I'm here to convey to the committee the governor's vision for where Oregon needs to go for a brighter and more secure energy future. The governor wants Oregon to lead the nation in renewable energy technology, development, and project generation. Why renewable energy? First, it plays to our strength. While Oregon may not have the coal, natural gas, or oil resources of other states, no other state has a greater diversity of renewable energy resources. That bodes very well for Oregon as the world and the nation accelerate their focus on reducing fossil fuel emissions and shifting to cleaner energy sources. Oregon has a strong history of renewable energy development. It has benefited from the use of small and large-scale hydroelectric power for decades. It also is blessed with outstanding biomass and geothermal resources. More recently, wind energy has taken off with some of the most concentrated wind resource development in the nation in eastern Oregon. Solar energy also has made significant inroads recently, first in the form of solar water heaters, and now with residential and commercial solar electricity. And the governor is very hopeful that wave energy will become the next big new renewable energy resource with its national headquarters here in Oregon. On the transportation fuel side, Oregon is poised to compete nationally in ethanol, biodiesel, and other alternative fuel options. And once cellulosic to ethanol technology is proven, Oregon will be positioned to become one of the nation's premier producers of alternative fuels. Already, one biodiesel refinery has opened in Oregon, with several more in the development phase. Similarly, three ethanol facilities are well on their way to project completion, with several others also in development phase. Second, renewable energy offers one of the greatest economic opportunities for Oregon, particularly our rural sector. Investment in renewable energy will keep more of our dollars in the state rather than sending them out of the state and abroad. The ethanol and biodiesel facilities are being sited in places like Clatskanie, Boardman, Ontario, and Klamath Falls. And the feedstock to serve those facilities will increasingly be grown in Oregon by Oregon farmers. The governor announced last week that the first new biomass facility in the United States in over a decade will be built in Lakeview. And others will soon follow in places like Warm Springs and Eastern Oregon. Klamath County is aggressively expanding its use of geothermal energy, and the Oregon Institute of Technology in Klamath Falls has plans to receive 100% of its heating, cooling, and electrical energy from geothermal sources. The wind farms sprouting in Wasco, Sherman, Gilliam, Morrow, Umatilla, and other counties are providing diversified income to the landowners and the local tax base. And the promise of wave energy with the first commercial project in the nation proposed off the coast of Reedsport and several others in the planning stages off Coos and Lincoln counties will bring economic opportunity to our coastal communities. Third, renewable energy helps Oregon do its part in combating global warming and reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. The governor agrees with the growing consensus in the scientific community that global warming poses one of, if not the greatest, risk to our health, environment, and economy in the coming decades. In 2004, the governor appointed the state's first ever global warming advisory group to assess the threat of global warming and to recommend actions the state could take to combat global warming. Top recommendations from the group was to establish greenhouse gas reduction goals for the state and to greatly accelerate Oregon's development and use of renewable energy. The governor established greenhouse gas reduction targets, including reaching 10% below 1990 levels by 2020, and committed to accelerating development of renewable energy. The electricity and transportation sectors account for more than 80% of Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions. So transitioning to greater amounts of renewable energy and stepping up our energy efficiency and savings will significantly reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. Here I note that while most of my testimony focuses on renewable energy development, the governor understands it is essential that Oregon continue to invest in cost-effective energy efficiency and conservation programs. Similar to our targets for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, the governor has announced goals of achieving a statewide 20% energy savings through conservation by 2020. At the very least, this will require extending the 3% public purpose charge and looking for other opportunities to support the Energy Trust of Oregon and other energy efficiency programs. And finally, renewable energy will provide long-term security to Oregon and the nation. The governor asked in his inaugural address, what could have been done with the projected $2 trillion that will be spent in Iraq had a portion of it been invested in transitioning the United States away from fossil fuels into homegrown renewable energy? Over the past 4 years, the governor has taken significant steps to move Oregon forward in that capacity. As mentioned, he created the state's first global warming advisory group, endorsed their report and recommendations, and began implementing them, including adoption of the Clean Cars program last year and creating a follow-up task force to look at the possible design of a cap-and-trade system for Oregon. Another key recommendation from that group is part of the governor's energy agenda for this session, adoption of a new renewable energy standard, also sometimes called a renewable portfolio standard. The governor and this legislature also took a few steps forward last session with passage of an appliance efficiency standard bill and increase of the residential energy tax credit program. And we tried to pass biofuels legislation that did not make it through the session. The governor has made passage of biofuels legislation another key part of his energy agenda for this session. Finally, the governor has shown commitment to state government, leading by example on renewable energy. He has directed staff and state agencies to develop a plan for state government to use 100% renewable electricity by 2010, the most ambitious effort of its kind in the nation. The Department of Administrative Services has instituted a green building policy. The governor also has directed the state vehicle fleets to transition to more fuel-efficient and cleaner vehicles, such as hybrids and ethanol-burning vehicles. The Oregon Department of Transportation already has committed to using a blend of 20% biodiesel in its vehicles in the Portland metropolitan region, and the Department of Administrative Facilities fuels its vehicles with an 85% blend of ethanol wherever feasible. With all this momentum around renewable energy, there is an enormous opportunity to make major strides this session and to put Oregon among the most progressive states in the country on renewable energy policy. So what are the governor's key priorities for renewable energy and global warming policy this session? As mentioned, passage of a renewable energy standard and passage of biofuels legislation, including a renewable fuel standard, top the list. Another priority is expansion of the business energy tax credit program. That program is a unique tool that Oregon has to compete nationally for prized manufacturing facilities in the renewable energy sector and will be an even greater tool if expanded. The governor also hopes there will be a serious conversation this session around global warming and that significant steps forward in policy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions will reach his desk. Finally, the governor has committed in his budget to a major increase of funding for renewable energy research and development. Key budget items include $5 million to support wave energy, $3 million for a new center of excellence focused on sustainable technologies, including renewable energy technologies, $2 million for a pilot initiative to install solar energy in schools, $10 million for funding of 5 renewable energy initiatives in the Oregon University system, including the previously mentioned geothermal projects at the Oregon Institute of Technology, $2 million for Oregon state government to move forward on the governor's commitment to achieve 100% use of renewable energy by 2010, and $2 million for investment in retrofits of school bus and truck engines to reduce their air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions. As you can see, the governor is excited about the opportunity to make major strides forward on renewable energy this session, and he looks forward to working with this committee and the rest of the legislature and stakeholders to make these important strides a reality. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Vantoff. Mr. Graney, you have 4 minutes because you used one of yours. Because okay. There are some panels here. So.
That's fine. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Mike Graney. I'm Director of the Department of Energy. Let me just make a few points. First, energy plays an important role in our economy, and the cost of energy does. We spend in Oregon nearly $10 billion a year on all forms of energy. Most of that money goes out of state, and much of it goes out of the country. But our energy savings efforts and our development of renewable energy to date has kept those costs from being nearly $1 billion higher. We also have some decisions to make on acquiring new resources. Representative Jensen mentioned earlier the importance of hydroelectric facilities. Hydro provides about 40% of Oregon's electricity. Another 40% comes from coal, and people don't realize that, but coal plants in the mountain states as well as 2 coal plants in western Washington and Oregon provide as much energy as hydro. About 10% comes from natural gas, and virtually all our plants built in the 1990s were natural gas. They were cleaner, they were quick to build, and initially they were cheap. But the price of natural gas has become increasingly expensive and problematic. I think we can look at coal costs continuing to rise as well because of environmental restrictions focused on mercury and on CO2 emissions. That leaves us some choices of where we go. We think renewable energy is viable. We have over 500 megawatts operating now on wind and biomass in Oregon. That's as much as two natural gas power plants. And our siting council recently approved in one day 750 megawatts more of wind, and we have another 750 megawatts pending. I provided you two handouts that one is a renewable energy action plan that was adopted by the governor last year after an extensive public process that has over 130 recommendations for specific actions that state, federal, and local governments and others can take to promote renewable energy. And then I have a summary also of the legislative package that Dave mentioned in terms of our energy tax credits and the biofuels package and the renewable energy standard that have details in those. We think that legislation will put us on a firm path for developing renewable energy as our primary forms of energy in the future, and alternative fuels to play an important role in our transportation needs. We think this is a good package. We're very excited to work with the committee. And I'll turn this over to Mike MacArthur, who led the public process to review these bills over a year with a group called the Renewable Energy Working Group. And Mike spent countless hours working and guiding that group.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Mr. MacArthur.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Mike MacArthur. I'm here in my capacity as the chair of the Renewable Energy Work Group. The governor's office asked me to convene this group about a year ago, and we've had 11 sessions. We've had a membership of about 35 people, including all the interests, I think, around renewable energy and electricity and fuel issues in the state, including some legislators. Representative Dingfelder and Representative Burley have attended some of our sessions. We've met in Portland, Eugene, Bend, Salem, Newport. The idea of the work group was to try and implement the Renewable Energy Action Plan. We attempted first to deal with those issues that needed to come before you legislatively this session, and they were roughly divided into three areas: the area of fuels, the area of economic incentives, and the other area was the renewable portfolio standard that the governor is calling for. We created subcommittees around a couple of those issues, the fuels and the incentives and the community interest. All had subcommittees, and then later on we created a task force on the work group on the cost cap provision of the renewable portfolio standard. Many of the members of this group are in the room today, and you may be hearing from them later on. The legislative proposals that we're bringing forward from the work group include concepts of an expanded business energy tax credit, residential energy tax credit, and biofuels legislation. The renewables portfolio standard was held by the larger group because it tends to be somewhat controversial. People fear the mandates. People fear the additional costs that it might bring. What I fear is the rising costs of traditional types of electricity. And it is interesting to note that the PUC's decision yesterday to not authorize the production of two coal plants and the costs then will be associated with having to upgrade those plants to be able to produce electricity from coal brings the gap, whatever gap there may be, even closer together, I think. We had a briefing in May by the nation's leading expert on renewables portfolio standard, and he talked about some of the other 19 other states and their programs that have these standards. Dr. Ryan Weiser is his name. He actually happens to be from Oregon, which is interesting. So we've dedicated the last few sessions to that issue. There isn't, as I understand it, yet draft legislation on the renewables portfolio standard. It's still being drafted, Mike, that you'll see that soon. In it is included a cost cap. And that was the last subject of our last discussion of how do we limit the exposure of folks that have to go out and acquire renewables, the industry that needs to acquire those, and that discussion is still going on. We're going to meet in early February and try and finalize that. It's interesting to note that the cost of natural gas is rising faster than the projections. And I think that in any calculation of will renewables really cost more in the future, you have to look at that history. Biofuels legislation is largely agreed to by consensus of the committee. Seems that that was not so controversial. We've had generally a consensus type process, and some will disagree, and you'll hear from them. The business energy tax credit is unique in the state, in the country. Oregon has one of the best advantages for energy projects with this, expanding it from 35% to 50% and increasing the size of the projects from $10 to $20 million, I think makes a lot of sense, and that legislation will be coming to you. Residential energy tax credit will make incentives for renewable energy more effective by allowing qualifying items in the same year to come from solar water heater or solar electric system, as well as for multiple energy efficient appliances. It increases the tax credit from $1,500 to $6,000. That legislation will be coming forward as well. The biofuels package provides a package of measures to encourage greater development and distribution of the use of agricultural and forest products. It expands property tax incentives. It establishes a new tax credit for producers and collectors of biofuel raw materials. It prohibits the sale of gasoline that contains MPBE, provides that existing mandate on state agencies to use an ethanol also applies to biodiesel. It operates an income tax incentive for consumer use of biofuel, and it establishes a four-year sunset. That legislation will be coming to you. The renewable portfolio standard would subject all the utilities in Oregon to a primary or secondary standard. Utilities who produce more than 1% or more of the total retail electrical sales in Oregon would be required to provide 25% of their electricity from renewable sources by 2025. Interim targets will be at 2011, 2015, and 2020 of 5, 15, and 20%. The 28 smaller consumer-owned utilities that serve less than 1% of Oregon's load would be required to meet their renewables by requiring anything 60% or greater of their load growth must be provided by renewable energies by the same targets. In 2015, 40%, and in 20% in 2015, 40% in 2020. No consumer-owned utility would be required to give up access to low-cost power from BPA. Eligible resources would include wind, solar, ocean, geothermal, biomass, with some restrictions, hydropower in non-protected waters, and the derivatives of those resources that were operational after January 1st, 1995. The idea of this is to acquire new renewables. It's interesting to note also that California and Washington both have aggressive renewables portfolio standards, and their measures allow them to essentially poach. So they can come to Oregon and get their renewables here, and so if we're selling to California and Washington, they wouldn't count towards renewables the standard. The cost cap has an off-ramp. It will be integral because the cap will be based on a percentage of the utility's total revenue requirement. Many of those rules will be developed by the PUC. The public purpose charge that we have now would be extended through 2025 by this legislation and serve as a complement to the renewable portfolio standards. The renewable energy portion of the public purpose charge would be limited to smaller scale renewable energy projects less than 20 megawatts, which are eligible under the purpose standards set up by the PUC. There is a non-binding goal that one-third of the renewable energy resources would be small-scale renewable energy projects. I say non-binding goal. The status is that we've met and endorsed the PETC and RETC. We're still working on the RPS. It remains in outline form, and a placeholder bill has been established. If there are detailed questions, I'm sure they'll come later, but I'm happy to answer any other questions you may have.
Thank you, gentlemen. You set a fine example for the panels that will be coming after you. Any brief questions for this panel?
How long do you have, Madam Chair?
We have 5 minutes.
3 to 5 minutes.
The questions. We have four other panels that will be coming up.
I'll save my questions for
Okay. And just a reminder that there's a lot of information that you're going to hear today, and we are going to be holding detailed hearings on many of the legislative proposals that you'll be hearing today. So I don't want to discourage you from asking questions, but today we're really trying to present there's going to be a lot of information being presented. So certainly if there's questions for this panel, Representative Jensen, I encourage you. Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate it. Before the next panel comes up, I was remiss in not mentioning that Representative Burley is not stuck in snow somewhere. He, unfortunately, couldn't be here. He's had back surgery, is out this week, and is hoping to return either by Friday or early next week. So I've been in conversation with him, and he's doing fine. So we wish him a speedy recovery. I hope he's listening, and I think he'll be joining us hopefully soon. So the next panel we're going to have up is the private utilities, Gary Bauer from Northwest Natural and Brendan McCarthy from Portland General Electric. And again, brief is the operative word here, gentlemen. And Brendan, it's nice to see you. Brendan, for some of you may remember, used to work for Legislative Council, but I think he got a better offer.
I was informed that I would have 5 to 10 minutes, and I just wanted to say that, of course, in the years of working in Legislative Council, it was a skill to actually take 5 minutes to say no. So I hope that you'll bear with me, and I'll go through my PowerPoint as quickly as possible. That's a little boy.
For those who can't see, is this your son, Brendan?
That's my second son. I had him 9 months ago.
Okay. He's a good-looking boy.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Just a reminder to identify yourself for the record, Brendan.
Right. My name is Brendan McCarthy, and I'm here representing Portland General Electric. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me to be here today. This first slide is a picture of the future of PGE. This is when we rung the bell on the New York Stock Exchange last April and became once again an independent, Oregon-owned, investor-owned utility. And we are very proud and happy to be Enron-free and look forward to moving forward in that regard. You're going to hear a lot from us this session on our stay-at-home strategy, and we'll probably be talking to you all individually, but we're again proud to be an Oregon company. We want to stay an Oregon company, and to the extent that we can, we want to make sure that the regulatory environment allows us to continue as an Oregon company. We'll probably save all those details for later. The general overview, we have almost 800,000 customers. About 80% of that retail load is residential and commercial customers. We serve a 4,000 square mile service territory, which encompasses 52 cities, the biggest ones, of course, Portland and Salem, but we run all over the Portland-Salem metropolitan area. We have almost a third of the population of the state in our service territory. We have 2,700 employees, and we're in the top 10 in terms of revenue for investor-owned Oregon companies. Recently, we were a proud recipient of an EPA Green Power Award. We're the number one supplier of residential green power in the country. We send green power to over 6% of our customers. And we have a historic peak load of over 4,000 megawatts. Generally speaking, our average load is about 2,400, 2,500 megawatts. This slide shows where we are right now with where we get our power. We are a fairly diverse utility with about a quarter from hydro, about a quarter from gas, and a little less than a quarter from coal, and a little bit more than a quarter from contracts that we enter into. We have some long-term contracts with mid-sea, mid-Columbia River hydro facilities, and then we're also a net short utility, meaning we buy a lot of power on the open market. In the future, you'll see the coal shrinking a little bit, and as our Port Westford plant comes online this year, you'll see our gas percentage increasing a little bit. This graph should show you our future resource needs. The red line represents the load growth. I think it's based at 1.4% annual load growth. You can see the blue section this year bumping up due to the coming online of our Port Westward and our Bigelow Canyon wind projects. You can see that the lighter shade of blue or bluish green is our power from our contracts, and as those contracts begin to expire and tail off, you can see by 2012 we have a relatively sizable shortfall. Port Westward is our newest generation facility. It's about 400 megawatt capacity facility. We have gone a little bit of extra mile and installed a state-of-the-art G-class turbine. It had originally been considered to have an F-class turbine, and this is a more efficient model from Mitsubishi. It was $287 million installation. And we are nearing first fire, which should happen in the next few weeks and should probably, if everything goes as planned, come online sometime in late spring. In our integrated resource planning process, which is a plan we go through every few years to determine where we're going to acquire our resources, we pledged to acquire 200 megawatts in wind in our last IRP, and we are doing that. Our Bigelow Canyon wind farm, we've got the first phase of that, 126 megawatt capacity. We have existing wind capacities at Klondike 2 and Van Sickle Ridge. We are also looking at other alternative energies, the renewable energies. Wave energy is something we think has a lot of promise. We're helping to, we're contributing money towards that promise at OSU, at their research facility. And we think it can be cost competitive in the relative near future. And let's not forget energy efficiency. We have identified 44 average megawatts of least cost energy efficiency that could be done beyond the capabilities of the Energy Trust of Oregon. And those are in schools and small businesses and residential weatherization. And we think it's wise to go forth and try and capture that energy efficiency, the cheapest resource is the resource we don't have to build. It's a map showing our wind facilities. You can see out near Milton Freewater, our Van Sickle Ridge, and Klondike 2, and right near Klondike 2 is the Bigelow Canyon. When phase 2 and 3 of Bigelow Canyon is built out, it may be as large as 450 megawatts capacity. Related to our environmental footprint, we've been in the news a fair amount in the last year. In relating to haze in the Columbia Gorge, we volunteered to be first in line for the DEQ's haze regulatory process. Relating to mercury emissions from Boardman, we agreed to attempt to reduce our mercury emissions by over 90%, and we'll spend over $100 million on multi-pollutant controls. And our CEO, Peggy Fowler, came out last month stating that we believe that national limits on greenhouse gas emissions are a good thing, and we promote the adoption of market-based mechanisms to accomplish those goals. On reliability, we're in the top 10% of utilities across the country for reliability. We're in the top quarter of customer service satisfaction. We have below average operating costs compared to other electric utilities across the country. We invested $70 million in the system and reliability last year, and we expect to do more of that in 2007. We take an all-risk approach to outage planning, meaning we're looking at all sorts of things, be they earthquakes or even pandemic flu. We think that we conduct outage drills regularly, and we think there are some things that we can do to improve our outage response. And I think this slide is probably one of our one of the more important slides. We do a lot of polling. We ask our customers what they want, and we listen to them. And you can see that most of our customers, residential and business customers, have a clear preference for renewables and conservation. They are not familiar with nuclear generation and next generation coal technology, which you may hear about as IGCC, integrated gasification coal, where the coal is sort of liquefied and there's a product extracted from the coal, and that is used to fire the power plant. The there is possibility for carbon capture with that technology, but our customers are not very familiar with that technology. And the future, we just finished a general rate case. We believe it was a fairly balanced decision. It included costs for bringing Fort Westward online and for higher power and fuel costs, primarily natural gas. Our customer classes will see a 1.3% increase overall. And our demand continues to grow by over 6,000 customers a year. It's about 2%. It's like adding a new Oregon city every year. And we are a cost of service utility, meaning that we don't receive more profits if we have higher fuel costs. Those are not part of the revenue mix. And that is it. And I'll take any questions that you have.
Great. Well, thank you, Mr. McCarthy. We're going to hold questions until after Mr. Bauer's presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. I'm going to have Brendan see if he can plug this in, and I'll walk through this quickly.
Just I think that's it.
Do not.
And just to let members in the audience know, we did invite PacifiCorp, and they couldn't be here. So just so you didn't think we were leaving out the other big private utility.
Well, you have a presentation in front of you. The first chart, basically, I think this is supposed to warm up.
You need some assistance up there?
Yeah. My technology to give you just a brief overview. The Northwest, there are actually three local natural gas distribution companies in Oregon. We are served by two pipeline companies. One that comes down basically down through Seattle. That's the Williams Pipeline. They also have some facilities over in eastern area. Okay, here we are. In this area, the other one is TransCanada's gas transmission, and they come down through the central part of the state. The other utilities that serve are Avista Corporation, which is based out of Spokane, and they serve in southern Oregon, the Medford area, and also over in eastern Oregon, and Cascade Natural Gas, which serves in the Bend area, central Oregon area, as well as also some over in eastern Oregon, and they're based out of the Seattle area. The moving to the next page, I'll run through this quickly. Just a brief overview of Northwest Natural. We're 147 years old, soon to be 148 in the next month or so. We're the first gas company in the Pacific Northwest. We serve 630,000 customers in both Oregon and southern Washington, primarily in the Clark County area. One of the things I will mention is that we build our systems out, and we primarily serve in more populated areas. People do not have to buy natural gas. You don't have to have it, so you have to find the market. We're actually out there trying to market basically high-efficient gas furnaces and those types of things. We are growing at twice the national average of other natural gas companies, and primarily when you compare that against East Coast, it's fairly well built out in terms of natural gas. And then just one other comment that we ranked third in the J.D. Power's 2006 gas utility residential customer satisfaction. We were fifth the prior year. Just to give you a quick background, 15% of the gas supplies come from Canada. For Northwest Natural, we actually get 80% of our supply from Canada, and the other comes from the Rocky Mountain area. To kind of comment on others who have commented about the price of natural gas. For many years, the West Coast basically was the market for Western Canadian gas. And then recently this heavy line that's up at the top was built. It's a pipeline that now moves natural gas over into the eastern part of the United States. That changed the pricing mechanism considerably for us. Other thing to point out is down at the very bottom, you'll see You'll see a lot of heavy lines down there, and let you know these lines do equate to flows of natural gas, so you can determine the volume. We'll let you know that when Katrina and Rita hit, that took out a lot of production for a period of time, which caused a very large spike in natural gas. For this last year, a number of marketers thought that might happen again, and so we saw the price of natural gas when you were out buying in forward-looking time frame, that was up. We chose not to buy. We didn't think that was sustainable. And once folks figured out that they weren't going to have major hurricanes this year, the price of gas dropped. It's a commodity. It goes up and down. And one of our other things that will influence it is, again, because of the East Coast, is weather. And with the East Coast weather being warmer this year, it has had a dampening effect on natural gas prices. Just to give you a quick kind of look at how natural gas from a national basis is being used. You have primary power generation, be for electric generation. To share with you some regional numbers, in 1999, 12% of the natural gas in the region was used for electric generation. In 2005, it was 23%. Industrial was 45% in 1999, and it's now dropped down to 33%. And in some cases, that's a reflection of industrial, basically companies shutting down, moving offshore, going elsewhere. Some things we quickly use for managing the volatility are our gas supply contracts. We use financial hedges in going out in the marketplace. Physical storage in the Mist area, which is up in Columbia County, we actually inject gas into the ground and store it there and then pull it back out in the winter. And that was a natural gas field that we had partnered with some other folks, took the gas out, and that's now a storage area for us. We also have some other couple of tanks that we use. Physical storage, that gives us about 15% of our core supply then during, and 50% of our peak supply on a weather like the last couple of days. Other things we can use is interruptible sales. We actually have a number of industrial customers who have an interruptible contract with us. We can stop their use of gas and send it elsewhere. Another one we do is called recall agreements, where we can actually take gas that isn't ours, that's gas that they have actually contracted for themselves, and acquire that gas and use it for residential customers, small commercial customers, hospitals, and things like that during cold seasons. Quickly on rates, natural gas rates are a little different than the electrics. We have two components of our rates, the commodity, which is natural gas, and then the cost of service, pipelines, trucks, people, et cetera. The commodity costs are passed through at wholesale. So whatever we pay, that part of the rate is just passed on. And that right now is 60-plus percent of your rate is the commodity. What we do earn our return on and our profits is on the actual distribution of the gas, so again, the cost of service. Just to let you know, our commodity prices went up about 3.5%. We'd actually projected those going up higher, and as I mentioned earlier, because of forward-looking prices, people's concerns over hurricanes, et cetera, we chose not to go out in the market at that point, and that benefited our customers, so we were able to lower the projection. We've had two general rate increases since 1989, and those are associated with managing our day-to-day costs. And they ranged in the 2 to 5%. We've also doubled the number of customers, and we at the time have been using the same number of employees. We're actually on a reorganization and our downsizing as we go forward. Just to quickly comment on something that we worked very closely with the Oregon Public Utility Commission, our customer organizations, and the environmental community was to design what we called a conservation tariff. What we wanted to do was get our customers and our shareholders on the same side of the table. Until then, basically, even though the commodity is passed on at cost, rates are done on a volumetric basis, and our profits were based on that volume. And so we worked with them to develop a different type of structure that disconnects those two. And so it removes any disincentive to promote conservation. In that process, we added a public purpose charge to our bill. We are not part of what's known as Senate Bill 1149. The process adjusts for declines in usage due to price elasticity and conservation. And as a result, we continue to make enough money to pay the cost of service element. And again, we don't make more money when during cold weather. And as a result, we don't lose money during warm weather as well. It's become a national model. I think the Public Utility Commission probably doesn't get any credit here in Oregon. There are 18 other states that are now looking at it, and it's actually Congress is talking about whether or not to try to promote this as a national model as well, and I think the Oregon Public Utility Commission deserves a lot of credit for their forward thinking. In conclusion, just quickly, we benefit from being close to Rock Canada and the Rockies. Demand and supply balance will remain tight. We do need additional resources and infrastructure are necessary. As Brendan mentioned, public policies impact availability and price of energy, and we will continue to work with our regulators and our customers to manage costs. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Bauer. Thank you, panel. Are there any questions for this panel?
Chair, I do have a question. I think it's
Representative Cannon has a question.
Thank you. Mr. McCarthy, I think it's for Mr. McCarthy. You said 25% of PGE's power is purchased. Am I correct in thinking that that's on the open market?
On a power market? About a quarter is contracts, and some of those are long-term contracts, and some of those are on the open market. That's correct.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Follow-up.
Do you have any? Is there any way of giving a sense of where that power or how that power is generated originally, that 25% that isn't generated by PGE but is purchased through contract or on the market?
Chair Dingfeld, Representative Cannon, I don't have that information. I think we do have that information. I can try and get it for you. I think it would probably vary depending on how long the contracts are. But you're right that the generation is broad-based. It could be coal. It could be hydro. It could be wherever, you know, generated by various resources.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the panel? Representative Smith?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. Gary, I'm curious, is PGE still your largest customer?
I believe Georgia Pacific is our largest customer.
It's just it's ironic that there's a real interrelationship between PGE and Northwest.
We do have a number of projects that we work together on both as a customer and as an attempt to provide them with their service.
Great.
Some pipelines, et cetera.
Thank you. Just a reminder, Representative Smith, to use your microphone so folks on the webcast can hear us. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. Thank you very much. In the next panel, we will hear from the public utilities, and we have Tom O'Connor from the Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities, Don Goddard from Oregon People's Utility District Association, Jason Huser from Eugene Water and Electric Board, and Sandy Flicker from Oregon Rural Electric Co-op Association. And I appreciate you all squeezing together up there. Uh-oh, now I can't see him. We are very challenged in this room, as you can see, with the video situation here. So, Tom, do you want to start off first?
Madam Chair,
would you like to, Sandy? Okay, we'll go backwards. So, for
Good afternoon to the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to hear from the consumer-owned utilities in Oregon. We're going to present...
For the record, can you state your name, please?
Sandy Flicker, representing the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. We're going to present today. Each of us has a role, and we're going to start with Don Goddard. We will each introduce ourselves and provide the committee with a segment of information on the consumer-owned utilities, and hopefully by the end of our time, you will have a better understanding of who we are.
Great. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Don Goddard, represent the Oregon PUD Association. My purpose is just to contrast who the different customer-owned utilities are and how we're different from the investor-owned utilities. Investor-owned utilities are owned by stockholders and are regulated by the Public Utility Commission. We are owned by our customers, and we are not regulated by the PUC. We're 18 co-ops, 12 municipal-owned utilities, and 6 PUDs, and we generally serve the smaller communities and rural areas of Oregon. The way that we're the same is that we're each regulated or governed by a locally elected board. We're nonprofit. We sell our power at our cost, and generally we buy our power from Bonneville. It's transmitted over largely Bonneville lines to our service areas. Our people design, build, operate, and maintain the substations and power lines and services to businesses, homes, and farms in our service areas. And we all pay property taxes in different ways on those facilities. The way we're different is that the co-ops are private organizations under the law and formed under ORS 62. Municipal utilities are governed by their city charters and are subject to all the requirements imposed on other public agencies, things like open meetings law, public contracting requirements, public records, initiative, referendum, and recall of our elected boards. PUDs were created by a constitutional ballot initiative in 1930, or at least authorized by the Constitution, and the legislature sets out in Chapter 261 all the requirements that we must follow. We only have the authorities that the legislature grants us, and we also are subject to all the general provisions of other public agencies. And then, as I mentioned, we are not regulated by the PUC. Our elected board set the rates, the reliability requirements, and other policies for our utilities. But we are subject to the PUC safety requirements, to their pole attachment requirements, certain curtailment requirements, and for territorial allocations. So with that, I turn it over to Tom O'Connor, who will talk more about our sources of power.
I didn't know anybody still uses overhead, so this is good to see.
I apologize, Madam Chairman. I, due to the storm, I thought maybe I better go low-tech. And I,
actually, we're pretty low-tech kind of people.
Okay. Like I said, this room is really challenged. This is a test to make sure everyone's paying attention here.
For the record, my name is Tom O'Connor. I'm director of Oregon Municipal Electric Utility Association, and I'd just like my part is just to give a little background on our power resources and how we fit into the Oregon situation. As Mike Graney, this is a pie chart of Oregon as a whole. As Mike Graney mentioned, Oregon as a whole is about 40% hydro, 40% coal, and a number of other resources mixed in there. We are considerably different from that mix as a group. Most of the Oregon consumer-owned utilities buy their power from the Bonneville Power Administration. Bonneville Power is virtually 100% greenhouse gas free. It is basically the hydro system and the nuclear plant in Washington. However, and going to a question that Representative Cannon asked, Bonneville sometimes has to buy on the open market to fill in the gaps depending on weather and so on. And when they do that, the techies attribute the mix of the what we call the Northwest Power Pool, which is the system and the overall system in the Northwest. And so you take that average and plug it in. And so if you do that way, we pick up a little bit, you'll see a little bit of gas, a little bit of about 4% of coal in there as well.
You'll get it right by the end, Tom, there. This is why we went to PowerPoint, I think.
Yeah, right. This is just a comparison this will be in your packet, of the consumer-owned utilities in Oregon are compared to the two larger utilities
The pale color there is the consumer and utilities, PGE and PacifiCorp. Again, showing our power resource mix, everything to the this side of the wind is non-greenhouse gas producing resources. So again, we're overwhelmingly hydro-based system.
That same hydro system, incidentally, is the is one of the prime mechanisms for integrating the variable resources like wind that were that all the utilities are building now. This is again, this is in your packet as well. This is a bar chart with the showing the CO2 emissions from the various utilities and the various sources in Oregon, and you can see where we are there. A little bump. The next big bar is transportation. Next one over is industrial, direct use residential, and commercial. So we are very fortunate to have the large part of our fuel mix is greenhouse gas free. It of course has fish impacts, which we pay upwards of $500 million a year in mitigation and improvements for, but it is as I say greenhouse gas free. In addition to Bonneville, a number of the utilities have small local projects. Given Jason's going to talk a little bit about eWeb as an exception, but most of the consumer-owned utilities have done small renewable projects like local landfills at Coffin Butte and Short Mountain for a couple, for the co-ops and Emerald PUD. There's some small hydro facilities that folks have developed, like the one on Ashland's municipal system, dairy gas digesters in Tillamook. Those kinds of things. So they're, again, they're like the utilities. They're small. They're local. The very small utilities, as Don mentioned, we are primarily distribution utilities. We do not own generation. Most of my folks, for example, buy 100% of their power from Bonneville. A number of them take advantage of a Bonneville program called Environmentally Preferred Power, where we can buy at an extra cost a slice of Bonneville, primarily wind power. It's called EPP power. And finally, the other part of the resource mix, in conjunction with Bonneville, our local utilities all operate conservation and energy efficiency programs to reduce our power needs. And I'd be happy to answer any questions later.
We're going to hold questions to the end. And do you have handouts from the overheads that you just... We actually don't need the screen up as long as you provide handouts because the audience can't see it anyway the way it's pointed. So if you have handouts, it's easier for us to see than the screen, actually. So, okay. Jason, you're up next.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jason Huser, Legislative Affairs Representative for eWeb. Appreciate the opportunity to explain a little bit about where eWeb is situated. At Oregon's largest consumer-owned utility at 83,000 customers, four words have long been heard around the halls: focus on the future. That's how it was in 1911 when the very first eWeb commissioners were debating what to do with surplus power generated at the Walterville Power Plant, which was created to power Eugene's streetlights. That's how it is today. In the late 1980s, eWeb initiated an extensive integrated resource planning process. In this process, customers communicated with their utility through citizen involvement committees, focus groups, and surveys. Their advice that was given to our utility: invest in conservation and pursue renewable energy opportunities to help meet the growing demand of consumers and to help the environment. As a result, eWeb today currently spends 5% of retail revenues on conservation, one of the highest commitments among utilities. For well over a decade, eWeb has striven to widen the breadth of its energy portfolio boosted by $150 million in bonds approved by Eugene voters in 1992. Like most other public utilities, UEB still greatly benefits from hydropower in its portfolio, but diversifying UEB's portfolio and resources has significantly reduced the risk exposure to volatility in energy prices and address local and global environmental issues. Here are a few EWEB renewable accomplishments. In 1999, EWEB, PacifiCorp, and BPA partnered to build a 69-turbine wind farm in southeastern Wyoming, one of the first western wind farms outside of California, and the first that was owned by an Oregon public utility. More recently, commissioners recently agreed to purchase wind power from the Klondike 3 wind farm being built in northeastern Oregon, and we are moving forward with a geothermal project in Idaho at this time. EWEB also purchases renewable energy from the State Line wind farm on the Oregon-Washington border, as well as the Teton hydroelectric project in central Washington. Additionally, EWEB has contributed to the Solar Monitoring Laboratory at the University of Oregon, and we've also been a contributor to the Wind Research Cooperative at Oregon State University. And we will continue to study solar, electric, and ocean wave generation and other emerging technologies. Looking again to the future, EWEB continues to look to develop fiscally prudent renewable projects, and as a result of the most recent update of the Utilities Resource Plan, EWEB commissioners in May of 2006 dedicated 1% from electric rates towards pursuing additional renewable energy opportunities. EWEB is generally supportive of efforts to promote greater use of renewables, but a concern for EWEB is that utilities that have already made a commitment to renewable energies, even before it was popular, we're not entirely sure that we're going to get all the credit that we feel should be accorded. And, for example, EWEB finds itself in a position where we have some resources that are in sort of another world, where they may not be an eligible resource under say an RPS, for example, but they're also not a fossil fuel resource. And that's a little bit of a predicament, and I look forward to working with this committee to ensure that in the future we can resolve that predicament as far as a utility like EWEB is concerned, which has made quite a bit of progress in having a renewable portfolio.
Thank you. Sandy, do you want to wrap up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you can see from the presentations that we've had, Oregon's consumer-owned utilities are a web of utilities across the state that fill in the holes, basically. We serve some incredibly rural places, and we have some incredibly small utilities, and then we have Eugene Water and Electric Board. So we're very diverse. What I want to share with you today, however, are some of the key issues that are important to all consumer-owned utilities in Oregon as we talk about the future of energy. First and foremost is maintaining local control. All consumer-owned utilities are governed by an elected board of directors. They are not for profit, and they are owned by the customers they serve. These utilities were formed originally because either these service territories were of no interest to investor-owned utilities because of so few customers, or electricity customers chose to form a not-for-profit utility to serve their communities. These electricity customers were and continue to be very pleased and supportive of the opportunity to locally control their utility. In a recent survey that the co-ops did of a group, our grassroots program called Power of Community, 87% of those responding to the survey indicated that they wanted their utility board to make the decisions regarding both resources and operation of their utility. This has been a very effective model and has allowed consumer-owned utilities to offer not-for-profit service and power at cost. All consumer utilities are currently preference customers of Bonneville, as you heard from Tom, which means they can purchase primarily renewable hydropower from the federally owned hydro system. IOU customers receive benefits from this federal asset through something called the Residential Exchange Program, wherein BPA provides money to the IOUs for their small farm and residential customers to offset higher cost of other resources. So we all share in the benefits of that federal system that we're so very fortunate to have here. Because of our low density and difficult service territories, the access that we have to hydropower means that our small towns and rural communities can have electricity rates that are comparable to IOU customers. It is essential that we maintain our preference rights to BPA power. All consumer-owned utilities use almost exclusively renewable resources, either with hydro, wind, biomass, solar, and other renewable sources. And we are very, very, very proud of our commitment to renewable resources. However, it is very important that consumer-owned utilities have the tools necessary to interconnect these variable resources into their systems without causing safety or reliability issues. It must also be noted that, for the most part, consumer-owned utilities use the BPA transmission system, as Mr. Goddard suggested, and must coordinate their access to that transmission to serve their load demands. We own very little transmission. We're primarily, as Tom said, distribution utilities, so we have to work with other systems. Consumer-owned utilities are governed by different statutes, and you heard what those statutes were, but I just wanted to mention that it is extremely important, as we move through any discussions, that consumer-owned utilities do have statutory authority to do utility business and to successfully acquire renewable resources. Lastly, consumer-owned utilities are not regulated by the PUC. We are, however, regulated by the PUC for, they're not rate regulated by the PUC. They are regulated for safety, pool use, et cetera. Our locally elected boards of directors provide the regulation necessary to provide not-for-profit service and safe, reliable utility systems. New regulation without court benefit to our customers adds unnecessary cost to our very, very small and oftentimes very rural utilities. Those are the issues that we wanted to share with you today, a little bit about who we are and what our concerns are as we move through these discussions. And again, we thank you for the opportunity to let the consumer-owned utilities of Oregon share who we are with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that illuminating testimony. Any questions for the panel? Okay, excellent. And you have some handouts for us?
That is everything you ever wanted to know.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, the next panel, we're moving right along here, we're going to hear from citizen customer groups. We have Jeremiah Bauman from the from OSPIRG, the Oregon Citizens, Oregon Public Interest Research Group. I hate acronyms. Jason Eisdorfer from Citizens Utility Board, Rachel Shimshak from the Renewable Northwest Project, and is Mr. Edelson here?
Edelson.
Yeah, James Edelson, Interfaith Group and Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. So why don't we start off with Jeremiah and just work on down and try to get through and get everybody out here in time. Thank you all for coming, and please remember to state your name for the record.
Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, thank you very much for having us here today. For the record, my name is Jeremiah Bauman. I'm an environmental advocate with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG, and I will share in grief over the awkward acronym. I'm going to keep my testimony limited to a sort of a bird's eye view of the energy problems facing Oregonians and the resulting demand from Oregonians for solutions to energy problems and some of the specific policy options that we anticipate coming up before this committee and before this legislature this session. Let me just start by saying the bottom line message here, I think, is that Oregon has the resources and know-how to not just start addressing these problems that are facing Oregonians, but to really lead the country in transitioning from a fossil fuel-based economy towards a renewable energy future and towards cutting global warming pollution and other forms of pollution that are causing these problems. And so this is ultimately, I think, an optimistic direction and an optimistic setting for this legislative session. There's a lot of opportunity ahead of us, and the question is, how do we best seize that opportunity? Oregonians are facing an array of energy problems, and because of that, public demand for solutions to energy problems is at an all-time high. Renewable energy and energy conservation programs rank among the most popular problems, solutions that Oregonians in particular support. Briefly, and these problems will be very familiar to you, Oregonians are seeing rising prices. This comes up most frequently and most acutely around gas prices, especially during times like last summer. But it's also a problem around electricity prices and natural gas prices, which have been steadily rising for many years now. The rising prices also, I think, right at times like this, remind people the core problem they're worried about, which is our dependence on fossil fuels and our dependence particularly on foreign and out-of-state sources of energy, which ties in not just price problems but problems with foreign policy and the ways public money are being spent at the federal level. And then added to all of these, especially in the last 8 to 12 months, is rising public concern about global warming and the major environmental problems that our current energy system is causing. Oregon has already seen a 50% decline in snowpack in the Cascades, and that is the perfect reminder that global warming is not just an environmental problem, but really a society-wide problem. Shrinking snowpack means threatened water supplies for farmers to irrigate, threatened water supplies for salmon and the various parts of our economy that are tied to that, and threatened water supplies for hydropower. The opposite side of all these problems, though, is the opportunity we've got to move into a national leadership position in addressing these problems and transitioning our economy to a clean energy economy. The solutions that you have as policymakers typically fall into two broad categories. One is energy efficiency and conservation, and the other is renewable energy. I can't overemphasize the importance of energy efficiency and conservation. As I think Mr. McCarthy from Portland General said, the cheapest and cleanest energy is the energy we don't use. It reduces costs for consumers, it reduces costs for businesses, it increases our energy independence, and of course, by not generating that energy, there's no environmental impact from it. In terms of renewable energy, that is where you see the opportunities expand even more rapidly because of the amazing resources that Oregon has in terms of wind energy, solar energy. While we have a reputation as a pretty rainy and dark state, the truth is that all of Oregon has better solar resources than Germany, the world leader in solar power, and as we've heard a little bit about today, wave energy. Let me just outline briefly a few of the major policies in these categories that will come up this session and that Osprey is supporting. First, and I would argue foremost, is the renewable energy standard requiring that 25% of Oregon's electricity be renewable by 2025. This, I would argue, is the most important policy coming up for a couple of reasons. One is that Oregon already has very effective incentive programs. There are excellent tax credits and other incentives that companies and consumers can take to move in a renewable energy direction and in a more energy efficient direction. But one of the places that we are missing is the clear path and the long-term plan for our utilities to get to a much higher percentage of renewable energy. This is missing particularly when you look at other states. 20 states now have renewable energy standards on the books, and these are now seen as the most effective tools for promoting renewable energy development. In fact, those are the words of the Lawrence Berkeley National Labs and the National Renewable Energy Laboratories, who have done studies attributing most of the renewable energy development between 2001 and 2005, when particularly wind power has been exploding, to states that have enacted renewable energy standards. As just one example, after then-Governor George W. Bush signed Texas's renewable energy standard into effect, within a matter of a year or two, there were 700 megawatts of renewable energy under development. As Mr. Graney testified earlier, Oregon currently has only 500 megawatts, and that was developed over a matter of about 10 years. The other policies I'll mention briefly are expanding and improving the incentive programs that we do have in place. These include both the business energy tax credits and renewable energy tax credits. These also include, very importantly, the public purposes program and the Energy Trust of Oregon. This is an incredibly effective program that's been up and running for several years now. Thousands of Oregon consumers and businesses have benefited from their help with energy efficiency and renewable energy projects. As just one example, Blue Heron Paper Company is saving over $5 million a year because of increased efficiency in production. Lastly, I'll mention biofuels are, of course, an important component of our transition to a renewable energy future, and that is a policy package that includes both incentives and an important renewable fuel standard. And finally, the investments in research and development that the governor has proposed are critical ways for Oregon to become a leader, particularly in wave power and in positioning our universities as centers for the intellectual capital that it will take to make this transition. I'll wrap up with one final note of context, which is that historically, energy policy has been a very bipartisan issue in Oregon, and most of the states that have enacted renewable energy standards has been with full bipartisanship, whether we're talking about California or Texas. So Osprey, in particular, is eager to work with people on all sides of every issue to come up with the right energy policy for Oregon.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeremiah. Jason?
Good afternoon, Chair Dinkfelder and members of the committee. I'm Jason Eisdorf, attorney for the Citizens Utility Board. CUB was created by voter initiative in 1984. We're a membership organization, but the state law grants CUB statutory standing in state administrative and judicial proceedings, and we tend to hang out in the legislature as well. CUB was instrumental in elements of Senate Bill 1149 that created the 3% systems benefits charge that allows the Energy Trust to make investments in energy efficiency and renewables. And also, it was a mandate to the investor-owned utilities to provide green power options. And both PacifiCorp and PGE have done very well by that. We don't take a narrow view of the customer's interest that includes only rate levels. Instead, we try to advocate for the best energy policy that considers rate impacts, equity among stakeholders, and environmental stewardship. A low-cost strategy that is high-risk may not be the best energy policy, and we're mindful that if environmental externalities are not considered at the outset, not only will the environment suffer, but ratepayers will end up putting the bill down the road, and the delay may make reparations significantly more expensive. As a result of our philosophy, sometimes we align ourselves with industrial and commercial customers on certain issues, and sometimes we deviate from those customers. One of those issues that we may begin to deviate from our industrial and commercial brethren is what CUB believes is the most significant driver of policy in the energy sector for the next couple of years, and that is global warming and the cost of carbon regulation. This is the Energy and Environment Committee, and that is apropos because there has always been a close connection between energy extraction and production and the environmental consequences. This will, I think, will only become more pronounced as we move into the future. The electricity sector produces 40% of the man-made carbon emissions in the United States, and the U.S. is about 25% of global man-made emissions, so the electricity sector in the U.S. Is responsible for 10% of man-made carbon emissions globally. There has been talk about the system mix in the Northwest, that the Northwest is something like 40% coal. That's not, because that's an average, no utility actually meets that. In fact, PacifiCorp is something on the order of 80% pulverized coal in its portfolio mix. Global warming is an enormous challenge and a risk to Oregon's utility customers, not because of the rising sea levels, not because of the loss of the skiing industry or the demise of salmon, because tributaries get too warm for reproduction. The risk I'm talking about is the responsibility and size of paying the cost of future carbon regulation. We're no longer at a point where we think that carbon regulation is going to come. In fact, it has already arrived. The Kyoto Protocol went into effect a year ago. The European Carbon Dioxide Trading System is up and running. In the northeastern United States, there is a Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which is a carbon control regime. Washington, Oregon, and California have formed the West Coast Governors Initiative. In California, just this past year, they passed AB 32, which is an economy-wide carbon cap-and-trade system. California also passed SB 1368, which prohibits any new long-term financial investment in resources that have a carbon profile worse than an efficient natural gas turbine. And Washington State in November passed an RPS. So here's one of the problems. This is an issue that is going to be in the fore in the electricity sector. And as of right now, regulation tends to assume that the customer is going to absorb, is going to take the risk of those, the cost of future carbon regulation. Utility right now, I think, assumes that the shareholders are not going to be on the hook for the cost of carbon regulation. And therefore, the utility doesn't have a real any skin in the game. They don't really have an incentive to conduct a genuine analysis of the future costs of carbon. at this point, the utilities believe that they're not really at risk for the future cost of carbon. What I think is appropriate is for the state, through the legislature, to begin addressing global warming, identifying the policy goals and directives and mechanisms that begin shifting the utility resource portfolios away from fossil fuel and toward cleaner, low-carbon resources. I believe that there will be a national or international carbon regime at some point. It is better for the electricity customers, it's better for the economy of the state for Oregon to get out ahead of any national or international limitations. By doing so, we can, over a longer period of time, make those kinds of adjustments. So ultimately, in closing, we can either start thinking about global warming now, or we will be paying directly in energy rates for carbon regulation later. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. I do have a couple of handouts. Do you want them now?
Sure.
Oops, let me keep one of those. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Shimshak, and I'm the director of the Renewable Northwest Project. We're a regional nonprofit organization promoting solar, wind, and geothermal resources in the four states of the Northwest: Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. Our members are both active in the energy industry and nonprofits. It's the one time when the advocates and the businesses actually get together to promote the same goal. And I wanted to spend my 5 minutes here talking about just kind of a high-level overview of what's going on with renewables in the Northwest and specifically in Oregon. And I wanted, through that summary, to focus a little bit on economic development and on costs to popular activities. When we're talking about renewable energy, we're talking about naturally occurring resources that are inexhaustible. And Oregon, as other members have said, has a lot of these. I was able to participate this last year with the Western Governors Association, who were given the task of trying to determine whether we could meet 30,000 megawatts worth of our electrical needs over the next 10 years with new renewable resources. And what we found through that analysis is we could do well more than that. So there's plenty of stuff out there. Renewables help diversify our resource base. They help stimulate local economic development. They help the environment and protect public health. We like renewables because our region was really built on a renewable base. We are blessed with the hydro system that has helped us keep our high quality of life and help keep our air breathable. And our hope is that we can continue to invest in renewables, increase our renewable edge, but diversify into a lot of different kinds of renewables to help keep that advantage for the Northwest. Other people have said, a lot of people think we're 100% hydro. We're not. We're 50% fossil. On the project side, there are 14 major new renewable projects that have been developed in the last 10 years in the Northwest, and six of those are actually in Oregon. Oregon benefits greatly by having those projects in our state. As you can see from the economic development fact sheet here, in the region in general, over $1.3 billion in new investment in these projects, $2 to $3 million annually in royalties to landowners, because landowners lease their land for these wind projects. It kind of creates a second crop for them, so they can have something to diversify their own revenue base. And $6 to $7 million a year in new property taxes just from these seven new projects that have come along in the last 2 years. Lots of new jobs, too. More than 1,300 construction jobs and about 80 permanent jobs have come with these projects. From a policy perspective, each of the four states actually has a variety of different policies that promote renewables, both for small-scale and for large-scale resources. And they come in lots of different
forms, but Montana and Washington State now have a renewable energy standard or a renewable portfolio standard. Washington just passed it by a citizens initiative this last November. There are, as we said, 20 other states across the country who have this same policy, and you know, I love it for Oregon to be on the cutting edge. We're not exactly on the cutting edge for this one, but we need to play a role. We also have our system benefit charge here in Oregon. The utilities, the investor-owned utilities, are required to offer their customers a voluntary program, which complements some of our other policies. So if you're a customer and you want to go beyond what your utility is doing, you can sign up for up to 100% renewable power. And across the entire region, there are now 100,000 customers who are participating in those projects. And last on cost, cost is always a popular subject when we come to renewable energy. Nationally, there has been an analysis of the 20 states that have implemented renewable portfolio standards, and the cost difference for customers in those states is plus or minus 1%, nothing very dramatic. The Northwest Power Planning Council in our own region does a plan for what kinds of resources we ought to take on in the next 20 years, and they've determined that the cheapest resource is energy efficiency, the next cheapest resource is new renewables, and they've called for the development of 6,000 megawatts of renewable power over the next 20 years. In Colorado, a state that has a portfolio standard, their primary investor-owned utility, Xcel, says that they've saved $14 million just between 2004 and 2005 by investing in some wind resources. In Washington, Puget Sound Energy says they're going to save, their customers will save $170 million over the lifetime of two wind projects that they've just secured. And in Oregon, we do have the help of the Oregon Energy Trust through the citizens of Oregon. Three of the most recent wind projects have not requested any money from the Oregon Energy Trust to help pay for those renewable projects. They have been at market. So by way of conclusion, renewables provide stable costs, predictable over the long term. We're blessed with a generous endowment of these resources in Oregon and throughout the Northwest. They have low costs and low risks. We get the bonus of local economic development, which helps support our rural communities. The people like it, but we need additional policy to ensure that we can transfer some of those proposed projects into real operating projects. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be a last-minute substitute for Jenny Holmes, who, because of the weather conditions, couldn't make it out of Portland today. My name is James Edelson, and I am representing the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. For the past 3 years, you should have copies of the testimony coming around. For the past 3 years, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon and the Oregon Interfaith Global Warming Campaign have been significantly engaged in working out the state level for sound policies on sustainable energy and global warming. We are committed to this work for the long haul and have been involved in a variety of ways over the years. In 2004, EMO's Executive Director, David Leslie, served on the Governor's Global Warming Advisory Group. In 2005 and 6, me, a member of the steering committee of the campaign and the Oregon Interfaith Power and Light, served on the Governor's Carbon Allocation Task Force. And now in 2006, Jenny Holmes, the Environmental Ministries Director, served on the Climate Integration Task Force that the Governor has appointed. We have been honored to be included in this effort because for the faith community, global warming is one of the foremost moral issues of our time. We feel that the Oregon legislature has a unique opportunity to help Oregon become a leader in global warming solutions. In 2006, the Oregon Interfaith Global Warming Campaign released the Oregon Climate Charter, which lays out the ethical principles of reverence for life, stewardship, and social and environmental justice as the foundations for thinking about energy and global warming policies. It recommended the following policy objectives. Increased efficiency and energy conservation is the highest priority in policy, as we have heard from several speakers before.
strategic planning to develop and implement a long-range, comprehensive, and coherent strategic plan encompassing energy production, transmission, energy use, transportation, land use, research, innovation, and economic viability. Transition to sustainable energy, greatly reducing or phasing out traditional coal use as an energy source and phasing in new renewable energy and cogeneration. Using full cost accounting and measuring energy performance that also includes the price to society of the emissions. And leadership, make Oregon a leader in sustainable energy and energy efficiency so that our expertise in this field becomes a highly valued state export to other states and nations that can use our experience. In addition, the Climate Charter makes specific policy recommendations, most of which are reflected in the recommended legislative priorities we have for this session coming up. Number one, expand renewable energy and reduce reliance on fossil fuel-based energy. And that includes the renewable energy standard we've heard about. That also includes clarifying the statutory authority of the Public Utility Commission regarding greenhouse gas emissions, which we've heard previously also. And it also importantly includes establishing a greenhouse gas performance standard for electric utilities serving Oregon. Number two, we do want and we do know that there are opportunities to increase energy efficiency in the state. Possible policy approaches are extending funding for the Energy Trust of Oregon, as is included in the Renewable Energy Standard, increase energy efficiency standards for appropriate appliances, and explore an increase in the public purpose charge for the Energy Trust. One of the things that I learned about being a member of the Governor's Carbon Allocation Task Force was that both the Energy Trust and the Public Utility Commission have identified significant opportunities beyond what the Energy Trust is achieving today and with the existing resources. And we believe there's a real opportunity to expand the public purpose charge to capture these lost opportunities. And as we've heard before, this is both the least expensive and the largest resource to tackle global warming pollution in the state. And also improve building standards for a targeted increase in energy savings in new and existing buildings. The third important part is establishing some type of institutional structure in the state of Oregon for achieving the greenhouse gas emission reductions. This is a broad but also a very focused effort, and the existing institutional structures in Oregon do not fully encompass the ability to tackle this in a comprehensive manner. And so we proposed, or we will see proposal, we believe, for something like a climate commission or a climate energy commission to both do the mitigation efforts, the leadership and technological development efforts through the universities, perhaps, and also to start tackling the regulatory mechanisms needed to achieve greenhouse gas reductions. And the fourth one, which is very important to our targeted mission, is to reduce the impact on low-income consumers of any increase in utility rates, whether that's because of fuel prices, utility increases in costs, or because of expenses for greenhouse gas emissions. One of our particular concerns that I've mentioned before is the Emissions Performance Standard, also known as a Global Warming Pollution Standard for power plants. We feel that this is the essential first step for the Oregon to reduce its carbon emissions in order to approach the future regulation of greenhouse gas emissions without having invested in power plants that emit more than what turns out to be about around 1,000 pounds per megawatt hour. This is very important because the more money that is invested in this, these resources that are very carbon intensive will prohibit or preclude the state from inexpensively attacking the global warming pollution reduction job we're going to have in the future. So this is our one of our top priorities for this session. We look forward to working with you in the 2007 legislature. This is truly a time for leadership for Oregon's legislatures on both sides of the aisles. We thank you for this opportunity to share our views.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. Are there any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you so much. And last, thank you for bearing with us because we're running a little few minutes behind. We will hear from private industry panel that consists of Lisa Dotto from the Oregon Business Association, Chris Taylor from Horizon Wind, Erica Hagerdorn from the Public Affairs Council for Industrial Customers of Northwest Utilities, and Julie Brandis from Association of Oregon Industries. Lisa, how about if you go first?
Okay. Madam Chairman and Committee, thank you for allowing me to come and speak to you today. I am pleased to be here to provide the Oregon Business Association's perspective on upcoming energy issues. And I do have some handouts here as well.
Lisa, can you state your name for the record?
My name is Lisa Adato, and I'm the Director of Environment and Economic Development for the Oregon Business Association. The Oregon Business Association is a statewide business organization made up of a variety of businesses, unified by their forward-thinking approach to business issues in Oregon. We believe in a balanced and fair approach to business issues. Our legislative agenda was developed by a vibrant committee of over 30 business professionals and approved by our board of directors. Committee members come from companies large and small from around the state. We include farmers, retailers, apparel manufacturers, software developers, utilities, energy developers, lawyers, engineers, and many other types of businesses. So we're really unified by our overall approach to the mega issues of Oregon, making Oregon an improved business climate rather than specifically focusing on the interests of one particular industry sector. The proposed energy legislation was voted as a top priority within the environmental area for our association. OBA supports Oregon's transition to renewable energy and renewable fuels as part of both an economic development strategy and as a means of achieving energy independence, security, and eventual energy cost savings for the business community. Recently, at an Oregon Business Summit, a meeting convened to discuss the Oregon business plan, sustainability was selected as a key strategy for Oregon's economic prosperity. With sustainability, Oregon is positioned to stake claim as a leader. Oregon will be able to develop technologies, expertise, and a reputation in this area and build on our international reputation that already exists. People who want to be involved in sustainable businesses will move to Oregon, invest in Oregon, and look to Oregon for leadership. Clean energy represents an important component of sustainability. Energy powers all of our endeavors and should be a centerpiece of sustainable strategy. We also believe that climate change represents a risk to economic interests, and clean renewable energy is a strategy to reduce global warming pollution. However, as the past years have shown, creating a new energy economy isn't easy, and it won't happen on its own. In order to execute a new plan, several building blocks need to be put in place. First of all, we need to publicly state our intentions and our goals so that we can move together towards the future. We need laws and policies in place that encourage us to move in the direction stated in our plan, and those laws should include both incentives and specific targets and requirements. We also need investment into new technologies and procedures. We are proud to support a set of far-reaching policies that will promote clean energy in Oregon. We support these proposals and urge that they be passed into law. Specifically, we support the biofuels package promoting alternative fuels for transportation. We support a renewable fuel standard for biodiesel and ethanol based on in-state production, and incentives for farmers and producers to use clean energy. We support the renewable portfolio standard. Oregon should join the other states in requiring that a percentage of Oregon's electric load come from new renewable energy. We believe that this can create new jobs and markets in Oregon. We believe that safeguards must be put in place and will be put in place to protect businesses and consumers from excessive or unreasonable costs. We support an increase in the business energy tax credit, and we support an expansion of the residential energy tax credit. We believe that those incentives are important. We also support investments recommended by the Oregon Innovation Council, including a signature research center that focuses on sustainability and will include research on green building materials, clean energy, and bioproducts. And we recommend a grant supporting the nation's first commercial-scale wave generation park on the Oregon coast. We believe that this is a historic time in Oregon and for the world. Energy issues provide both great risk and great opportunity. We recommend bold action. Thank you very much for your attention and time.
Thank you. And we're running a little short on time. The Transportation Committee is waiting outside. Fortunately, the chair is Representative Byer, so she's given us about 5 extra minutes. So I'm going to have to ask you maybe to cut it down to 4 minutes if you can. So, Julie?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chairwoman Dingfelder and members of the committee. For the record, I am Julie Brandis, representing Associated Oregon Industries. AOI is the state's largest business organization. We have a broad-based membership across the state of Oregon. Since 1996, our members have made energy policy, energy costs, and energy mandates a priority. The AOI Energy Public Policy Council has the following core principle: to have a competitively priced, safe, and reliable electric power system. Beginning a year ago, AOI's Energy Public Policy Council began meeting to discuss what we believed then would be the primary energy legislative issues. The Policy Council then presented final positions to the AOI Executive Committee and Board. The AOI Board adopted these positions, policies, and principles without opposition. I don't speak greatly to this, but we do support the expansion of BETCI, the Business Energy Tax Credit. The first primary issue our council looked into during the interim, AOI supports the current public purpose charge. In fact, we were instrumental in the original passage of this legislation. But we do oppose changes that would first increase the 3% public purpose charge, extend the 2012 sunset, expand the PUC's ability to modify the charge, or shift funds among the accounts, or shift authority to increase the charge from the legislature to the PUC. We hold this position in conjunction with a growing list of business trade associations because the public purpose charge and the energy trust are relatively new. 2007 is too soon to know how each of these, all the programs are working. The original legislation supported by groups ranging from CUB and Osberg to AOI and IGNU suggests that 2011 is the best time to discuss this expansion. And by the end of this year, the charge will have collected over one-third of $1 billion. Energy rates continue to rise, and therefore the public purpose charge continues to collect more money. And my back of the envelope estimates are the first year of the public purpose charge, it collected roughly $40 million, and at the end of 2007, it will be collecting roughly above $60 million, maybe $67 million. And that's an annual number. As far as the renewable portfolio standard, during the interim, beginning a year ago, January, the AOI Energy Public Policy Council and AOI staff began meeting with the governor's office, the PUC, and other RPS supporters who participate in the governor's renewable energy work group. AOI members are very supportive of renewable power. In fact, many members voluntarily choose to pay a premium for renewable power, and these are significant loads that are purchasing renewable power. We supported and lobbied for the public purpose charge, which collects as much as $11 million a year to buy down the above market cost of renewables. Despite a record of support, our members remain concerned about the legislative mandate that we've seen proposed at this time, primarily because customers bear the risk. As far as private utility customers are concerned, the mandate disrupts the integrated resource plan, a process that serves to protect and provide certainty for both customers and utilities. Recognizing this risk, AOI Board adopted a broad list of principles for an RPS. As the legislature develops and begins to modify the governor's proposal, we will measure the legislation against those principles. As examples, those principles address broad concerns such as rate impacts, the cost cap structure, including what is in the cost cap, what the cost cap base is, what is contained by the cost cap, and what is external that increases costs in relation to the cost cap, and how the cost cap addresses capacity and firming power. We will also be watching what the definition of what the legislature defines as renewable. We will also be looking at how the legislation addresses reliability issues associated with capacity and reliability issues associated with the transmission of renewable power. And we look forward to working with this committee on that piece of legislation.
Good. Thank you, Julie. Thanks for being brief, and I apologize, but I'm getting dirty looks from my colleague over here. But we did get short, cut short 10 minutes from the beginning. So we have your testimony. Maybe you can give us an overview, state your name, about ICNU, and then if we can move on to Chris, that would be great.
I'll be quick, Chairwoman. I'm Erica Hagedorn from Public Affairs Council today on behalf of industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. You all have our testimony point by point. I'll just go over it really quickly so Representative Beyer doesn't jump over the dais and come and get me. Senate Bill 408, ICNU supports maintaining Senate Bill 408 and would oppose any change to that legislation or any attempt to circumvent Senate Bill 408 that was passed last session. As far as the renewable portfolio standards go, the proposals that we've seen...
Excuse me, can you keep...
I'll keep going.
No.
The proposals that we've seen proposed 25% by 2025, and ICNU is concerned that... currently, these proposals don't include hydropower, and as Representative Jensen stated, it's a homegrown renewable energy source that we need to consider. Senate Bill 1149 and 3% public purchase charge, we support the existing public purpose charge. As far as Oregon's carbon initiative, we hope that proposals coming to the table can be further discussed, and we feel that any move for an initiative is premature. And then we support the current franchise for fees. So I hope that fit into your timeline, and I'll take your questions.
Thank you. And last but not least, Chris.
Hi, my name is Chris Taylor. I'm here for President. I will try to talk as quickly as possible. I apologize for not having printed handouts. I will get those. I only found out about this request at fairly last minute.
We also know you'll be back, so it's not the last
we'll
time we'll see you.
I'll just hit a few high points. Horizon Wind Energy is a national developer of wind energy projects. We're owned by Goldman Sachs.
And Chris, your name?
I'm sorry, Chris Taylor. I did say it. I just said it really fast. Chris Taylor with Horizon Wind Energy. And we are a national developer and owner and builder of wind power projects. We've got a local office here in the Northwest that I lead, and we're building a project right now in Representative Smith's district. In fact, we just started clearing ground for that this week, and we're very excited about that. We'll be building a 100-megawatt project in Union County called the Elkhorn Project. We've also just recently completed a larger project in Washington and have more on the way elsewhere here in the Northwest. I just want to hit three quick points, and then I'll let you move on with the next hearing. There's a lot of talk about policy. You're here to talk about energy and policy, and I guess the first place I would start as someone who's in the energy business is that all energy choices are driven by policy. Anyone who tells you that such and such outcome is a result of the free market is not telling you the truth. Every single aspect of the way energy is produced, transmitted, delivered, and consumed is heavily, heavily driven by government policy. You may like or dislike various aspects of that. I have opinions on all of those things, but it's all driven by policy. None of this is a free market. So you're starting from a heavily manipulated market, and I think that's really important that there's subsidies and policy choices implicit in the way the current system works, and any further changes that we make are tinkering with an already heavily manipulated system. That said, it's heavily driven by policy because it's central to how we live, and I agree with everything that's been said. Energy is a necessity of modern life, and we need to be very thoughtful about how it's generated and how it's delivered. Not surprisingly, as a wind energy company, we're delighted with the discussion of an RPS here in Washington. We in Oregon, following what's happened in Washington, California, Montana, Nevada, and the rest of the country. I would just add two quick points on why we think that as a developer of wind energy projects that it's in the public interest. Economic development, you've heard a lot today, and you'll hear more in the future, but as a result of this project in Union County, we'll be employing probably 125 people at the peak of construction. We'll be employing probably a dozen people in long-term family wage jobs that don't require a college degree, and we'll become probably one of the largest taxpayers in that county. The second piece is from the ratepayer side. We're selling that output on a fixed, totally fixed, with no ifs, ands, or buts, price for 20 years. There is no fossil fuel resource in the world that can guarantee you a price for 20 years. That's just a simple fact. It's about the only resource out there, and even Bonneville rate cases are subject to renewal more frequently than 20 years. So the long-term rate stability, the flat fixed price, which as a ratepayer you're exposed to risk when you buy from a fossil fuel under a fossil fuel contract, the utility has a provision in there to pass along the costs of those fuels. I'm not saying it's wrong. It's something that we need. We need a diverse mix. We need all of those things. But renewables are about the only thing out there that can offer you a guaranteed price, and we think the economic development benefits that brings are significant, and I'm sure we'll be back to talk more about the details, and thank you very much for your time.
Great. Thank you, Chris. Any quick questions for the panel?
No.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much. I think we heard an excellent overview today, and with that, I will close the informational meeting of the House Committee on Energy and Environment. Thank you.